Welcome to S&C Critical Insights. I'm Annie Ostrager, and I'm a partner in our litigation group and a member of our labor and employment and criminal defense and investigations practices. Today, we're going to talk about what boards should be considering in the wake of the Me Too movement. With me today to discuss this is Melissa Sawyer, a partner in our mergers and acquisitions group and the co-head of the firm's corporate governance and activism practice.
In the past 18 months, we've seen a lot of senior executives at large corporations get toppled over so-called Me Too allegations. It started to gather steam with Harvey Weinstein, but it continues to be a really hot topic in my practice as well as Annie's, with new headlines emerging weekly. However, I think the Me Too discussion has grown much broader than just a few headlines. It's not just about specific instances of sexual harassment against employees anymore. It now also goes to workplace culture more generally. For me, it's about companies trying to create a workplace culture of respect and having zero tolerance for behaviors that are inconsistent with their policies and values. It's also about the challenges of identifying and fostering talent in a workforce and managing human capital across what for many companies is a global footprint to make sure that the next generation of leaders has the opportunity to develop regardless of gender, sexual orientation, race, religion, or other attributes.
I agree with all of that, Melissa, and today we're going to talk about some of the legal ramifications of the Me Too movement and how companies are responding to it. In addition, we'll talk about workplace culture issues more generally. Because these situations are complex, the legal issues are multifaceted. As a litigator, I tend to focus on the litigation and investigation side of things, while Melissa tends to focus more on the governance issues. But in reality, as I think you'll hear as we talk, these two work streams are usually closely linked.
But even so, Annie, I'm going to make you go first. So let's start with a discussion of some of the litigation and investigation considerations. I mean, first of all, why don't you tell us, when a workplace misconduct issue comes to light, should a company immediately launch an investigation? What do they do?
It's a good question, Melissa. A broad-scale investigation may not always be necessary or appropriate. It very much depends on the nature of the allegation, the people involved and their seniority, the number of complainants, and whether the issues raised can appropriately be dealt with by employee relations and in-house legal resources. The company should, however, act quickly to make an assessment regarding how it will respond. If an investigation is called for, it can be done internally or with the assistance of outside counsel. If the investigation is done internally, a company still has to consider the independence of the investigation and privilege issues. Unless conducted or directed by counsel, an investigation will not be privileged. Retaining outside counsel may be appropriate if the complaint is serious or involves senior personnel. Any investigation should be conducted expeditiously, though it has to be thorough, and decisions about how or whether to document the investigation are critical. If a charge of discrimination is filed or there's a lawsuit, the company will need to be able to justify its actions and demonstrate that appropriate action was taken against the harasser. When documenting an investigation, it's important to be careful about what words are used in the reports, and this is also true when documenting internal complaints.
Annie, can you tell me a little bit about what types of litigation we're seeing come out of Me Too incidents? What kinds of claims are being made?
We've seen a variety of different things, including shareholder litigation, even shareholder litigation brought as a class action. A prominent example of this is the action filed against CBS after allegations that senior executives were engaged in widespread sexual harassment and other misconduct. We've also seen suits against former C-suite level employees, executives, alleging that they refused to give up control of a board after being terminated for credible allegations of sexual misconduct. And then we've seen derivative suits, also alleging that, you know, a board of directors has turned a blind eye to sexual misconduct and that the company's controls against this kind of conduct were ineffective. We've also seen large settlements, and settlement prices for these types of allegations are on the rise. And I think we should expect that after allegations of sexual harassment or other workplace misconduct become public, Shareholders will seek books and records and seek to investigate the board's knowledge of such misconduct. On that note, Melissa, maybe you can say a few words about board oversight.
This is a really tricky topic, and it's a hot topic right now. Let me start by saying, first of all, that boards have to strike a really careful balance between allowing management to handle the day-to-day management of the business and these types of issues while still providing appropriate oversight. I think there are some responsibilities that clearly fall into each of those separate buckets, and then there are probably some things that fall into a gray zone in the middle. And how you tackle that gray zone really varies a lot from company to company. It's going to depend on a lot of factors, including the size and scale of the company and its workforce. So it's one thing to be a public company that employs a few hundred people. It's another thing to have a multinational workforce of tens of thousands of employees. The company's track record on employee retention and workplace culture generally is also a consideration, as well as the scope of any known issues and potential conflicts of interest involving senior management, among other factors. In my view, the things that are firmly in management's court are things like making hiring and promotion decisions for employees below the most senior executive levels, as well as establishing routine HR and benefit policies for employees and handling the immediate response to employee complaints below the senior executive level. I think where a board can play a role is in making clear to management when the board should be apprised of developing situations. For example, in the past few months, I've seen a number of boards of directors considering policies to require management to provide quarterly or half-year reports to the board regarding employee hotline calls. They don't look for a tremendous amount of detail on individual claims, but the board is looking for enough context so that they can get a flavor for whether there are any patterns developing. I've also seen a number of boards say that they want to be consulted by management before the company enters into a settlement with an employee with a value in excess of X dollars, for example, especially if it's a sexual harassment allegation. I often get asked where responsibility for human capital management and workplace culture issues should sit at the board level. For example, a lot of boards think that because those issues touch on the HR function, it's logical to have the compensation committee take the lead on them. Here, again, in my view, I really think it varies from company to company. I do think that there are compensation-related issues that come up. For example, I expect in the upcoming proxy season, we'll see some examples of shareholder proposals seeking to link compensation metrics to workplace culture types of issues. I don't think that's strictly necessary, and quite frankly, those kinds of qualitative metrics for setting executive compensation haven't been well accepted by ISS and other proxy advisory firms. We have seen some companies adding Me Too clauses to executive employment agreements, for example, clarifying that a Me Too incident committed by the executive is grounds for for-cause termination. In reality, most companies already have some discretion in their comp plans to consider workplace culture matters. So I'm not suggesting that there's a one-size-fits-all approach on these issues. And more generally, just because a topic touches on HR and comp doesn't mean it has to be the exclusive purview of the comp committee at every company. Some companies that I work with very much want to keep this topic at the full board level because they think that directors there have a broader range of expertise to consider the bigger picture, including how these issues may tie in with other important issues like CEO succession planning.
That all makes sense, and we've seen a lot of compensation-related claims in both litigations and investigations that we've been handling as well. Can you talk about when companies have to disclose issues that relate to workplace misconduct or sexual harassment allegations?
Well, there's not much companies can do in terms of prophylactic disclosures, and nor would you want to. I have seen a few companies that are in the process of taking a closer look at their risk factors to see if they adequately raise workplace culture and employee retention as a risk factor. I think the disclosure issues really pop up when you have an actual incident in play. And clearly there are a number of mandatory disclosures that get triggered when a senior executive officer leaves a company, for example. It's it's no different when they leave as a result of a Me Too incident. Those disclosures can include a Form 8K, and they can also pop up in the company's proxy statement, for example. There are many good examples of how companies have handled these disclosures in the past, balancing the need to comply with SEC requirements with sensitivity to the victims and with a view towards managing potential liability for the company. For most companies, the thornier disclosure issues usually come up in relation to how you handle leaks and whether you make a voluntary disclosure of some kind in the context of trying to communicate with your employees about how you're going to fix the larger cultural issues that you've identified. In those instances, I think it's really important for the HR and legal teams to work together to craft those disclosures that both achieve the desired communication objective without increasing potential liability for the types of lawsuits that you described earlier, Annie.
That all makes sense. And recognizing that there's not much to do in terms of prophylactic disclosures, is there anything that companies should be doing to prepare for these types of incidents?
It's tough to prepare for something that's so unpredictable. Given the frequency of these incidents, I think it's wise for senior management to start discussing what steps they would take in the immediate aftermath of an incident, just so they can lead an organized response. For example, maybe they would want to talk about what kinds of incidents would require involvement by law enforcement and not just be adjudicated through the company's HR processes. They should also give some thought to what their internal HR processes are and when incidents need to be escalated above a particular production plant level, for example. We're also seeing some companies establish dual reporting channels for victims so that their complaints are not just handled by their local HR team, but also get sent up through the company's legal department for a second review to make sure they're being handled properly. At the board level, I think the number one thing we're seeing boards do is give more focus to succession issues, not just for the CEO, but also pressing other members of the management team on who their internal succession candidates are likely to be. This helps boards have visibility into Plan B in case of Me Too incidents, but also helps them to understand whether the next generation of leaders represents a diverse group of candidates, and if not, to consider whether there's anything management should be doing to broaden the pool. Lastly, we're also seeing boards and CEOs partner to set a tone at the top of zero tolerance for sexual harassment, sexual violence, and hostile work environments. Boards can support and lead this as culture carriers by mandating more transparency around the handling of claims and clearly communicating that these issues are a company performance metric on which they expect to stay updated. So with that, Annie, any last recommendations from a litigation or investigations perspective?
Well, I will say that a lot of what you just described also has clear implications on the litigation and investigation side, too. Having policies and procedures in place and clear reporting lines, as well as making sure that the board and other senior executives are setting a clear tone from the top, can go a long way in helping a company achieve a successful resolution of an investigation or a litigation where there's an internal complaint. And, you know, investigations and litigations involving sexual harassment claims are becoming more and more expensive in the post-Me Too era, as is settling those types of claims. In addition, states, including New York, are imposing limitations on the ability to keep settlements of such claims confidential. Boards should be considering the existence of internal policies addressing relevant conduct and how complaints are escalated and addressed should they arise. Anything else you want to add, Melissa?
No, thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.